Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman,
where smart people get their news.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Surprise! No Tom Hartman. Good morning, good afternoon, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and you lurking conservatives. It is I, Mark Maron, in for Tom Hartman, who is en route back from Scandinavia. That would be Scandinavia, wouldn't it? Denmark, Scandinavia. He's in on a plane and not able to do his show, so I'm going to be doing it. I've taken over. Pops lent me the car, and I'm going to see what we can do with it. If you don't know me, nice to meet you. If you do, glad to be talking to you again. I'm very excited to be here this morning. The music just keeps going on Tom's show. That's terrific. It just keeps going. That tremendous sort of uplifting, sort of folky feel. I'm ready to spread the love. That's what I do, kinda. A sort of panicky, anxious love. But, look, folks, it's about time. There's a couple of things going on with me. What we're gonna talk about on the show, hopefully, we're gonna talk about guns. We're gonna talk about McCain. We're gonna talk about Obama. We're gonna talk about our ability to not know the truth in our own brains because of the way the brain's designed. We're also going to talk about this never-ending cold I seem to have. I don't know about you, but lately, if I get sick, it used to be like you'd know you had a cold. You'd be like, I got a cold. But then things now, they start out as a cold, and then it turns into a chest thing, and then a head thing, and then your eyes water, and your ears bleed, and it goes on for 4 weeks, or 5 weeks, or 6 weeks, and you're like, I don't know, I thought it was a cold. Maybe it is a cold. Are colds supposed to last a year now? What is going on in terms of environmentally that makes us stay sick or continues to make us sick or is making us sick? Hopefully in the last part of the show, we're going to talk to a guy about that, about how genetically engineered food affects our immune system and how the environment itself affects our immune system. But one of the things I'm most concerned about and also excited about is that finally the Democrats or Democratic proxies are starting to take a shot at John McCain's hero status. I don't know if you would call it hero status, but the idea that he is a hero because he wore a uniform, a naval uniform. He was a fighter pilot. Does that make him automatically credible to be president of the United States? Because I've been saying this for a long time. I have been saying that, look, McCain is crazy. He's crazy. There's no way around it. You look at him, and if you didn't know who he was and you saw him talking on the street or talking in public, you go, that guy's got mental problems. He does have mental problems. I mean, let's be honest, folks. Deep down, no matter what you think about McCain, no matter what you think about his Senate record, he was a man in a cage, and he still is a man in a cage in his heart. Now, granted, it wasn't his fault. It was a war that we shouldn't have been in, but he was a man in a cage. And that makes him psychologically compromised. I'm not demeaning his efforts. I'm not demeaning his service to the country, but he's nuts. And there's no way around that. And you get people now, the propaganda about Barack Obama, this idea that is running around people who are indecisive. And let me tell you something. If you're really indecisive about McCain and Barack Obama, you should have your head examined. I mean, is it really that difficult a decision? Are you really on the fence on a day-to-day basis? Like, I just don't know. Because I talked to a guy who was fixing my dishwasher. And he's like, I don't know. I don't know who I'm going to vote for. You know, I like Obama, but this whole Muslim thing. I'm like, what Muslim thing are you talking about? You know, the Muslim thing. He was, he went to a madrasa. You know, who the hell knows what's going to happen? Is he going to snap? Is he some sort of Muslim time bomb that's going to blow up right when he gets into office? Seriously? Do you really believe that? Now, later in the show, I'm going to talk about why some people's brains do that and why our brains are designed to do that. Once a truth gets stuck in a certain part of your brain, you no longer know if it's true or not as it sits there for a while. And people can't even trust their own minds. But let's be serious. I mean, the idea that Barack Obama, that a guy could take the office of president, just all of a sudden snap, you know, turn a blind eye to fanatical Muslim extremists blowing up things in America to execute that president's own fanatic agenda, that, that's the president we have now. The idea that Barack Obama is some sort of Muslim secret agent is ridiculous. And if you believe it, you're ridiculous. But this other issue about McCain, I mean, seriously, I mean, Wesley Clark got on Face the Nation yesterday and said this.
He has been a voice on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he has traveled all over the world. But he hasn't held executive responsibility. That large squadron in the air, in the Navy that he commanded, it wasn't a wartime squadron. He hasn't been there and ordered the bombs to fall.
I have to say, Barack Obama has not had any of those experiences either, nor has he ridden in a fighter plane and gotten shot down. I mean,
well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president.
That is tremendous. It's about time. It is not only is it not a qualification to be president, and it is just by virtue of the fact that he was in a war, that all he talks about is this torture. I don't understand why more people don't say, look, you know, if you've been tortured after a certain point, I'm sorry you were tortured, but look, you might be psychologically compromised, and he's clearly psychologically compromised. In his mind, he's got a chip on his shoulder. I'm not sure that this whole torture thing that he stayed in the camp longer than he had to because he didn't want to offend his co-prisoners of war. He didn't want to look like a rat. He didn't want to look like a guy who was going to take the easy way out. But the truth of the matter is he did break. He declares it himself in his own book. He did snap. He did find his breaking point. He did participate in anti-American propaganda after he hit his breaking point. He did make those compromises. So what does that say about the guy's character necessarily? It's not like he was a prisoner of war and didn't snap or didn't crack. He did. And he's got a chip on his shoulder. Not only was he not an exceptional soldier, but he comes from a long line of soldiers in his family. So I'm not sure that a lot of what he was doing was some sort of rebelliousness, some sort of statement he was making to his father. See, I can do it too. This guy's a loser. And I don't mean to be extreme, but I do. He's a loser. He's a guy that was beaten down by a family legacy to show up and do his part in the military. He didn't quite make it up to grade. He was a prisoner of war. I feel bad for that, but he came back to the States. He struggled to get into the government. He married a rich woman. He is a kept man, and he's a waffler on policy. But the truth of the matter is he's nuts. I believe he's nuts. I believe that it's only a matter of time before you're going to see that chip on his shoulder. You're going to see what that guy's really made of. He's going to be in public. He's going to be talking about the Iraq war. He's already said things about our presence in Iraq that are completely disturbing, that we're going to be there 100 years, that we can win it. Win what? He was in one war that was unwinnable and a lie. So I think it's only a matter of time before John McCain is in public making a statement about the Iraq war, and he's just going to say, Listen, we can still win Vietnam. Can't you see it? We can still win this war. The VC, we can get them. What happened? What did I just say? Where am I? What day is it? What year is it? He's highly doubtable. There's part of me, honestly, folks, that thinks that by virtue of the fact that the Republican Party is running this candidate, they really don't want to win. They just don't want it. They owe McCain a favor. He was supposed to be the guy the neocons wanted initially, but apparently they had doubts then. So they're like, let's do him a favor. This isn't that big a deal. Because in all honesty, whoever is president is going to be holding the biggest bag of flaming poop in the history of this country. It is going to be a difficult 4 years, no matter who is president. There are many problems that are going to take generations, perhaps, to resolve because of the pit that this administration has dug us into. It's not going to be easy to pull troops out of Iraq. It's not going to be easy to get the economy back on track. It's not going to be easy to get the American people to snap out of their sense of denial and entitlement long enough to see the truth of where we are. That is what fascinates me more than anything. Right now, my peers, my contemporaries, even myself, that it is clear to me every day that we have reason to be afraid that the economy is going to completely crap out, that the bottom is going to fall out. But if you're an American, and this is almost everybody, it doesn't matter if you're progressive or whatever your point of view is, there's a certain amount of denial and entitlement that comes with American culture. It's actually part of the pioneering spirit. If everybody was so self-aware, so self-conscious, and caring in a deep, humane way, there's a good argument to be made that this country may not have ever been built. But at certain points, that entitlement, that sense of denial on a personal level, has got to shatter in order for people to come together and really facilitate some real change. And I think we're coming to that point. But even my friends, there's something about how you appear to other people. Everybody puts so much effort into pretending like they've got it together, that everything is okay. And I think a lot of people, look, if you've got a little bit of credit and maybe a job, there's some party that thinks that can't happen to me. I'm not going to lose everything. Well, just remember that the people that already have nothing are way ahead of the people that are about to lose everything in terms of knowing how to handle it. How are we all going to handle that? How are we all going to handle it without a complete panic? When are people going to wake up and start to take action, simple actions, to start moving this the other course? And that, of course, revolves around voting for the right people congressionally and in the Senate, and then making the right decision for president. Now, Obama is moving more towards the center in a very dramatic way. We're going to talk to Joe Connison about that in a little while. We're also going to talk about a trip I took to the Midwest. I'm happy to be here. I'd like to thank Tom Hartman for having me. I hope you enjoy. Our phone number is 866-303-2270. You can call me up and talk about anything, and I will take your calls. It is Mark Maron. I am in for Tom Hartman. Stay with us.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
All right, folks, it's Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom Hartman for today and Wednesday. Tom will be back live tomorrow. He's on his way back from Denmark as we speak. We're talking about McCain. We're talking about, finally, in a public way, the Democrats, Democratic proxies. Some people on the left have been saying this for a while, but they're starting to take into question or put into question his military service as being a foundation for his presidency, for his campaign, that the idea that just that you've been in the military makes you somehow a leader. McCain wasn't a leader. He isn't really a leader. He was a prisoner of war by no fault of his own necessarily, though he did prolong his stay as a POW. But he is psychologically compromised, I believe. And I'm also talking about how people, if there's anybody out there on the fence who could think that voting for somebody who is psychologically compromised, has a chip on his shoulder, easily manipulated, over a guy that is deliberate, thoughtful, and a politician. There's no doubting that Obama's a politician. He's becoming more so one. But just on a symbolic level, even, as I said before, the flaming bag of poop this next president's going to be holding is going to be one of the biggest in history. It's going to be a difficult 4 years. It's going to be a hard slog. It's going to require putting the right people, people with progressive ideas, into the Senate, into the Congress, and hoping that that will be enough to get some of that stuff put through in legislation. Because Obama, you know, may not be the leftist hero that some people think he is. He is moving more towards the center. I got an email about, or an IM just now, from my friend Z-Girl, saying that denigrating the Obama is a Muslim fringers will only aggravate them and make them swarm. We must speak slowly and kindly to our conservative brothers and sisters. Otherwise, they will stay on their side of the fence and will never get off this planet. I didn't know that we were planning on leaving the planet, but I guess that is an objective, that there comes a point, and maybe that's a progressive point of view, to say, look, you know, once it's depleted, I hope we have everything in place to go to another one and start over. Perhaps start a utopian enclave on another planet where everything is even and all rights are respected and people can exist in harmony and barter will be back and we can trade clothes and shoes for food and other stuff. But I don't know. I'm sort of sticking with the Earth plan right now. And I'm not sure. I've had this argument with other people before, this be kind to conservatives argument. Around stuff like this, I don't know if being kind is necessarily the right tact. I do know that they're going to believe what they're going to believe, no matter how false that may be. And hopefully I'll get to talk about why the brain does that. But I'm not sure that being kind is the right tact with people that believe this. Because it's ridiculous. And they're ridiculous. And the truth should stand as it stands. That you're not looking at some sort of super secret Muslim agent here. You're looking at a black man who is running for president. And a lot of people will do whatever they can to avoid, if they can, having a black man as president. And that means slander him on a whole number of issues that just aren't true. But I think what also baffles people is that you're not dealing with somebody who is ideologically narrow. When you deal with someone like McCain, who's trying to sell his sad self to the American people by taking a hard line on things like terrorism or his ability to lead or what is right in defense of this country, you're dealing with somebody who, and a lot of conservatives are like this, the reason they're conservatives is that their point of view is by nature narrow. So they are enabled to be bullying. They're enabled to have focused anger about the wrong things. They are enabled and justified in denying the truth of any situation. They are incapable of real debate and thoughtfulness in terms of how do we approach foreign policy? How do we approach some of the problems that we are having in this country now economically? How we approach problems that have to do with justice and have to do with the Constitution. And when you have somebody like Obama, and listen to me, I was not completely sold on Obama. I don't think he's the second coming. I'm excited about him for a lot of reasons. The primary reason I was drawn to him was his ability to just look off into the distance, just over there. You know, did you have that moment where you first saw Obama and you're like, what's he looking at, man? And you're talking to somebody, they're like, I don't know. And you're like, I don't know either, but I know it's good and full of hope. And that only he can see it. And I think that I'm on board because I think he's going to take us to whatever he's looking at because I want to see it, don't you? That there's this element that he has a posture, a stance. But just on a symbolic level, the idea of electing somebody like Obama president would so significantly change the spirit of America. And one of the reasons why a president is important, and I don't know how some of you will take this, is just the fact that he is a symbolic representative of what we want this country to be. And if you look at McCain with his comb over and his strange skin at this point because it's been pulled back, I don't know what they're doing to his teeth or his face, but I think the Republicans, because of their connection with the pharmaceutical industry, once they get a candidate that they're going to get behind, they start shooting him up full of stuff to make him human. But, I mean, that's a long shot with McCain. Look, I want to talk to Joe Connison a little bit about Obama's move to the center and a little bit about some of the statements at Wesley Clark. John Wesley Clark made, or Wesley Clark, who's John Wesley Clark? Am I making something up now? Look, it's Mark Maron. I'm in for Hartman. We'll be back with Joe Connison. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
All right, folks, Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman. Nice to see you. Nice to talk to you. I can't see you, and you can't see me. I don't know why the webcam's not on. It just isn't. They just put me in this room with a mic, and I got on it. I don't want to distract you people, but right now, as we speak, Barack Obama is making a speech, and he is shiny and on point and clear and full of hope and goodness. Not that I'm not saying who I'm voting for, but you know what I'm saying. I am. But he just brought up Mark Twain, and we'll get some sound from this later, perhaps. Don't know. But he said he was quoting Mark Twain's famous line of patriotism is loyalty to your country, loyalty to your country always, loyalty to your government when it deserves it. Basically, I'm paraphrasing here. But he's basically there, not defending himself, but addressing, as he does and will do honestly and thoughtfully, what is being thrown at him. And what is being thrown at him is slanderous crap that the right wing does. And the right wing will keep doing it. They'll keep planting seeds into, you want to know who the real Manchurian candidates are. They're people who don't listen to anything but right wing crap. And I got another IM from my friend Zoe, and she's saying that instigating, or not instigating, but you know, responding to this ignorance, to this simple-mindedness, and their commitment to sort of spewing this stuff, to respond to it angrily and assault them verbally for having those opinions, does nothing. And she tried to draw an analogy to me when I'm heckled as a comedian. And honestly, when I'm heckled, depending on where it's coming from, I will usually, if it's not just to ruin my show, I will say, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Where is that coming from? Why are you so committed to being annoying? How were you parented? Where are you getting your information? I will ask all those questions, and I'll do it aggressively. Sometimes I won't do it aggressively. But the problem with addressing conservative antagonism and slander and lack of truth and attacks in that way is that they are committed to it no matter what. You could show them declarative proof of the opposite. You could show them, you know, pictures, photographs, recordings of people. You could show them whatever it is that it would take to logically prove that what they are saying is untrue, and they'll say, oh, that's your point of view. Yeah, that's just a talking point. Yeah, that's you're trained to think that way because you're a liberal. There's no fighting with that. Beliefs are in place. And even if these people are economically compromised or called out in their own communities as being liars and dummies, they don't change. So what do you do with that? Do you indulge them? Do you try to cajole them into coming to your side by some trick? That's what got them to where they are. I'm sorry, I have a guest on the phone, and I'm not bringing him on. Joe Connison is a columnist for Salon.com and the New York Observer. He's the author of the book, It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. I haven't talked to him in a while. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm kind of full of the beans about a couple of things, but I guess what I want to talk to you right out of the gate about is it's pretty exciting that the Democrats are starting to attack the credibility of McCain's posture as a hero, as a campaign point in something that entitles him to be president.
Well, I mean, the fact that he's a hero is, I think, something that is really not open to dispute to 99.9% of Americans. Whether his heroism of 40 years ago entitles him or qualifies him to be president is a completely different matter. And, you know, I happened to see General Wesley Clark addressing that yesterday on Face the Nation. And he basically said, you know, guess what? It's heroic to pilot a fighter, and it's heroic to get shot down and survive in a prison camp. It does not mean that you would be a good president.
Well, that's, but my point is like, I'm not questioning his heroism and the idea that anybody who served their country in any way is a hero to some degree. But what my question is that even on an empathetic level, that if this guy was a prisoner of war for as long as he was a prisoner of war, that I think that despite the fact that it wasn't his fault, and that despite the fact that it may have been a heroic endeavor in his mind, that he is psychologically compromised. I think he's a little out of his mind, and I feel bad for him. But I think that not only is it not a qualification for being president, but I think it makes him troubled.
Well, you know, Mark, I'm not going to go there, but I would say that if you look at his attitudes that were shaped by the war in Vietnam, leaving aside his psychological state, you really can raise questions about whether he learned the lessons of that war. And that, in fact, is a highly pertinent question.
He's still fighting that war on some level.
Correct. And,
right.
And he believes, I mean, if you asked him, he says, he'll tell you, we got out of Vietnam too soon. Now, I don't know how many Americans know that we lost more than 50,000 American young men, mostly, in Vietnam. Not to mention killing many, many Vietnamese in that war. And the idea that, well, that wasn't enough in a war that was futile, and where now we've made peace and established good relations with the supposed enemy, Vietnam, now United Vietnam, but the Vietnamese regime that we were fighting. So why wasn't 50,000 men and women enough to get killed in Vietnam? And what does that say about how many would be enough to die in Iraq if McCain were president?
Right. And how does he interpret the idea of victory? And what does it mean when so much has been lost and so much has been sacrificed?
And, well, not and only the idea of victory, but the idea of what you go to war about, and, well, what, yeah, well, and why do you continue to prosecute a war?
Because, well, that's,
it seems to me that, that what he's saying about Vietnam is there clearly was no purpose in Vietnam other than, you know, the purposes that later turned out to be discredited, such as the idea that, you know, China was going to take over all of Southeast Asia. I mean, the ignorance about Vietnam, Asia, the entire region that beset the policymakers back then is very similar to the ignorance that we found among our policymakers who took us into Iraq, who didn't understand the difference between Shia and Sunni and how that would affect, you know, our occupation of that country and its future prospects. Back then, people believed that Vietnam was some kind of pawn of Chinese communism. And in fact, they hated the Chinese, even though they were both communists. And they considered the Chinese to be imperialists. And they would have been very happy to help us stop China from taking over Southeast Asia.
Right.
And yet we ended up in a completely fruitless and terrible war with them that have not only cost us many, many lives and a lot of money, but affected our ability to be a world leader for decades after that.
And it's also, you know, taking that sort of the Cold War idea of fighting at that point in time what was depicted as an enemy that would be a fight till the end of time, and that just constant fighting meant that you were somehow, you know, winning. That for him to commit to the frame or to put that template on the idea of terrorism, as many of the right does, is completely false.
Well, you know, I think the truth is that McCain regards any defeat or anything perceived as a defeat of the U.S. military as something that has to be avoided at all costs, and that our withdrawal from Iraq, in his view, would be a defeat. I think it has very little to do with any plausible strategy against the people who attacked us on 9/11.
And also it's very personal with him.
I believe it is personal with
him. Yes, and that,
I think that's a danger. And if I were Barack Obama, I would be asking him, well, what lesson did you learn from Vietnam?
Right.
Because I think that's a question that if he gave an honest answer, very few people would want to vote for him after that.
It's personal to where, like, as I was saying before, though, you don't want to go there, but it puts his state of mind in question to me. Now, let's talk about Obama for a second, because there's a lot of talk and a lot of actions that seem that he is, you know, making a fairly pronounced and fairly dramatic move to the center in some respects. Do you feel that that was inevitable? Do you think that it compromises him and how people will see him?
I think his liberalism was overestimated from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a very biased and a somewhat phony National Journal estimate that said he was the most liberal member of the Senate. It was something that National Journal did to John Kerry in 2004. When he was running for president, and it was inaccurate then as well. I think actually that Obama's instincts have always been fairly cautious and somewhat centrist, not in a bad way, but in a way that I think has enabled him to achieve some things both in the Senate and when he was a state senator in Illinois. But I also think, you know, the old cliche about how elections move, what happens during elections is true. Candidates run in a way that appeals to the party base when they're in primaries, and in the general election, they then seek to appeal to a broader electorate, which includes independents who mostly could not vote in primaries. And so, you know, this kind of perceived shift is inevitable. And in fact, you know, I think it shows that he's a supple politician. He's much like somebody who he supposedly dislikes very much, and probably would dislike the comparison. But he's like Clinton in this way.
Yeah,
he knows what needs to be done to win, and he wants to win.
And there are some things that he's doing to I don't want to use the pander word, but I can use the word pander. I mean, given that, you know, he is fairly clear about the death penalty, he's not against the death penalty. So making a concession like you're saying that, you know, it might be okay to have state sanctioned murder of a child rapist isn't a huge risk if he's going after those voters.
Well, and I don't know what his position on that was previously. I mean, I know he was not strictly opposed to the death penalty before. I don't know if he had a position on this particular issue. To me, you know, people on the left tend to get very, very excited about you know, a specific issue or a specific change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what matters more in a general election is really broad policy questions. if and when Barack Obama becomes president, there'll be lots of time to fight with him over the specifics of anything he says or does during this election. And that will be the time for people to mobilize around specific issues and pressure him.
Well, I guess the specific ones right now, I mean, to the left, it seems are in a lot of ways
the most serious one, where he actually has flip-flopped and in a way that I think is questionable, especially since, you know, he's promised to restore the Constitution and the damage that's been done by the Bush administration. This is now something he's done that raises a sharp question about that.
And what do you think the answer to that is, Joe? Because it seems like it wouldn't have hurt him, obviously, on the left or the right, certainly with some of the more libertarian of the right, to have stood up against this thing.
Yeah, I think you can disagree with their analysis, but I think the analysis of the Obama campaign was, we don't want to fight the election on this issue. We don't want to fight the election on the issue of, will you punish telephone companies for wiretapping people who the government suspects of terrorist connections? That's the way that it will be framed, both in the media and by the Republicans, and I think they're attitude was, you know what, we don't want to have that fight now. We'll have that fight later.
But the thing is that if you put that alongside of his choosing Jason Furman and Austin Goolsbee as economic advisors, these are pro-globalization people, philosophically, on some level, anti-union people. And you put that next to the decision to back out of the FISA fight, you know, what you have is somebody that looks like a corporatist sympathizer.
I can't speak to Austin Goolsbee. I happen to know Jason Furman, and he's certainly not anti-union. He's a lot of things have been said about him that are false. He's actually a progressive and a pretty strong one. He does believe that trade is good for the world economy and for the United States. But you know what? Obama believes that too. So if you wanted the the strictly anti-NAFTA candidate, you would have had to elect, I guess, John Edwards, although he changed his position on that in this campaign. So that is a very tough question, but I wouldn't say that picking Jason Furman as the economic advisor shows that he's a tool of corporate America or anything of the kind. I think, you know, Jason, let me just say one more thing about him. I wrote a book about Social Security 3 years ago when we were in the thick of the fight with Bush over privatization, and Jason was by far the most helpful economist to me, and in fact to many other people who are waging the fight against Social Security privatization. So it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, I guess it's just like, and I apologize if I mischaracterized him, but I just guess that the explanation of globalization and why we can't reinvigorate a manufacturing base in this country, I think is a real issue. And that when somebody is unwilling to fight a fight like the FISA fight, or talking about supporting, yeah, obviously globalization is here to stay, but you know, not having conversations about how do we bring jobs back to America, and also why not take the phone companies to task.
But I mean, first of all, those are two very separate issues,
right? Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But if you wanted to, I think it's very useful now to have a dialogue among progressives and within the Democratic Party and people around Obama and the various progressive economists of all stripes to have that discussion about how do we rebuild the economy? How do we start growth again in all sectors? You know, what kind of economy do we want to have? What do we want to make in the United States?
All right, well, I'm ready to have that too. And we got to stop there, Joe. It's great talking to you again. I appreciate you being here, Joe Connison.
My great pleasure.
You take care, man. When we come back, I will take your calls. It looks like we have a lot of calls about a lot of things. And I think that Joe is right, that is definitely a conversation we got to have before I completely run out of money. And before we all completely run out of money. And before our money is completely meaningless. Be right back. It's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, folks, about 5 before the hour, it's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman.
talking about Obama, about a little bit of a move towards the center, what that means to some people, talking about McCain in a, I'm not a reporter, so I can psychologically analyze whoever I want and make all kinds of judgments if I feel like it. And I will. Sometimes I'll keep them to myself, other times I won't. A lot of times they're wrong, a lot of times, well, you know what, they're not always wrong. But a lot of times you make judgments based on your own fear. A lot of times when you see things in other people that you find despicable, it's because you can't handle them in yourself. But I think that we can categorically say that McCain has mental problems. Larry, how are you, Larry? What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to respond in a sense. I believe earlier the comment was made that progressive liberals have to stop being single-issue voters. And I certainly think that can be said about conservatives, reactionaries as well. How many people out there will say that they'll vote for someone based on whether or not there's going to be the Pledge of Allegiance or prayer or evolution in public schools? I mean, taken separately, whether or not their guns are going to be taken away from them.
I don't think that progressives are as single issue voter oriented as the right are. I think that progressives are more able to see a broader spectrum of issues and ideas, and also able to try to look into the future a little bit and not be so personally and take it so personally and tight minded. I think that I've not experienced that. The left are more single, that they do that.
Myself, likewise, and perhaps I misheard you, and that's great. I'm glad there's that clarification. One more quick thing, more to the point about Obama. I'm reading my local paper, The Oregonian, here today with my breakfast, and Charles Krauthammer is slamming Obama for flip-flopping, U-turning, throwing a couple of his catchphrases here. So perhaps people can check out Krauthammer.
Yeah, I'll take a look at that on the break, too. Thanks for your call, Larry. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think that people on the left get, a lot of us get very committed to what I call boutique issues and issues that we are close to. But I think just by virtue of the nature of the left, if you're not an extremist in a certain way, that it is a big umbrella idea. It is the idea that we want to make it better for as many people as possible and want there to be some fairness and some progressive ideas moving forward. But I don't think we're like that. I don't think we are single issue voters by and large. And I think that we have probably a little more hope and education about how the legislative process works in facilitating some of those ideas in the long run. I'll take some more calls over the break. In the next hour, I'm going to be talking a little bit about guns. Because I don't have as big a problem with guns as I think a lot of progressives do. I don't know why. I grew up in New Mexico. There weren't many gun control laws. Everyone had a gun. The first time I saw a gun was in art class in high school. A guy showed me his .38. But I'm definitely open for conversation about that. Stay with me. It's Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom. Hope you're enjoying the show.
Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course you lurking conservatives. I am Mark Maron. I am in for Tom Hartman, who is en route back from his trip. He will be back tomorrow, and then I will be back on Wednesday. We have a lot of things on the grill right now. A lot of stuff sizzling. A lot of calls about a lot of stuff. This hour we're going to be talking to Emily Bazelon. Is that how you pronounce it, Lauren? Yeah?
I believe it's Bazelon.
Bazelon.
Mm-hmm.
That's a powerful name. Bazelon. She is the senior editor and legal columnist for Slate.com, so I can educate myself a little bit about how the Supreme Court works and why they decide what they decide. I was not around on the radio last week when the court decided that they would lift the ban on guns in Washington, D.C., opening up some sort of doorway, I'm sure, for states to re-legislate how they will find it necessary to re-legislate. I don't know about guns. The weird thing about me is I have some fairly definitive feelings about some things, but for some reason,
because maybe I have thought about buying a gun, because maybe I grew up with guns, and my dad was not a gun guy per se. He was no cowboy. He was a Jewish doctor from Jersey City who at some point, when we lived in New Mexico, said, you know what, I can just go buy a gun. I'm going to buy 10. And we had guns. There were guns around. And I occasionally would go shoot the gun out in the wilderness, just shoot it at things. It was exciting on some level. I never, ever thought about shooting somebody. I don't know why the guns were in the house. I tend to think that perhaps in a fit of panic, my father might have shot himself, but probably not somebody else. But there are these rules, these laws that state that if somebody is in your house doing bad things, you can shoot them dead in your house. And I always knew that, and I'd heard about people doing it in New Mexico, where I grew up. And when I think about buying my own gun, I don't know whether or not I could do that. But there's a couple of issues at hand, is that I don't know what a militia represents now. You know, if you read the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Unfortunately, now, I think at that time, a militia might be necessary if the state decided to take your guns away and take that freedom away from you and force you to do what you didn't want to do. In a democracy, that's no good. So if the state comes down on you, then you can put together a militia and take on the state. Unfortunately, at this point in time, you would need some fairly sophisticated weapons that I don't think are available on eBay or online at this point. I am yet to see anyone in my neighborhood or any neighborhood I've lived in with a rocket launcher or a tank parked in their garage. But I'm sure they're out there. I remember years ago, I was traveling across country. I was in some Midwestern city. I don't know what city it was. But wherever I was, they were having a gun show. And I thought, I got to go to the gun show to see what kind of people are at gun shows. Again, didn't have much against guns. And when you get to the gun show, you realize at some point during a walk through a gun show that these aren't sportsmen. These are not hobbyists. These are people with a plan. What that plan is, I don't know. But what does a militia look like now? I imagine it looks like something when the crap hits the fan, the militia are the ones that got enough people together to take over the Costco. That's what a militia looks like now. A militia looks like a band of people who are organized under one leader and all have guns that when it hits the fan, they will take you out for your food. Unfortunately, that's my fear of what a militia looks like. But in terms of protection, a gun is it's an interesting thing because I don't know how protected I feel by the police. I don't know if the police will show up quick enough to solve a situation that is life-threatening. I really don't know. Certainly here in the news, and certainly I've talked to people that were in trouble, that were in a threatening situation. You can get a restraining order, but if it is an ongoing threatening situation and you go to the police, a lot of times the police will say, well, there's really nothing we can do about it. So if your life is in danger for whatever reason, should you have a gun, or should you, or of you, the, are you of the state of mind that says, look, just take what you want, don't hurt me. Do what you got to do, just don't hurt me. I don't know. I think that in that case, a gun is not a bad thing to have. Again, I don't have one. Don't know why I haven't bought one. I think I'm afraid of guns, and that's a reasonable fear to have. But I do think that if it makes you feel better on some level, you can have it. But I also think that they're magnets for problems. I think that there's a lot of gun use in the house that I'm not sure that in an argument that my wife wouldn't have shot me. It's one of the reasons I didn't get her a gun. She used to tell me she wanted a gun. My house was robbed once. She wanted a gun in the house, and I wouldn't get her one because there was no way I wasn't getting shot with that gun. There just wasn't. Let's take some calls right now. The number is 866-303-2270. We can talk about the gun issue. We can talk about whatever issue it is that you have. Sean in Buffalo, New York, how are you?
Hey, Mark. What's up, man?
Not much, dude. Is this Sean the truck driver, Sean?
Yes, it is.
Hey, what's up, buddy? Where the hell have you been?
Me, man, I've just become apathetic, and I'm normally sleeping when you're on your video cast with Cedar.
Yeah. So what's on your mind, bro?
I got a question from PJ for you.
Oh, PJ, that's great. How's he doing? Yeah. Let's not get too personal.
Good. I went out for dinner with him when I was over in Syracuse last time.
So what's the question?
He wants to know why when a Democrat moves to the right, they call it moving to the center.
Well, I think, all right. Well, thanks, Sean. Let me try to address that. I mean, well, you don't, what do you got to go all the way for? You know what I mean? It's like, why not call it moving to the center as opposed to moving to the right? Because on some things, not unlike what Joe Connison was saying, and whether or not I believe in it, believe that it's the right thing to do or not, it seems to me that certain decisions have to be made during a campaign in order to get the vote. And a lot of that would mean compromise, and that would mean that the guy's moral integrity is in question. But I think that if you have true faith in somebody to lead you properly, that maybe the compromise he's making will, you know, once he gets into office, will be in your direction. Maybe he's just saying things to get into office, which I hope not. But I think the reason that they say that is to make sure they keep the left on board, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean, man. I got another question for you.
Okay.
Well, when are you going to have some more live dates up on your site, man? I got to see if I can catch it when I get somewhere.
Well, as soon as I get more live dates going, I will. Sometimes I get a little lazy on the site, but, you know, work's been a little tough to come by for everybody, me included. But thanks for the call, Sean.
Yeah, no problem, man.
I'll talk to you later. David in Blaine, Washington, how are you?
Oh, I miss you on Morning Tradition, but I'm so glad you're filling in.
I appreciate it.
You know, the media, since the primaries, and even now, has or aspects of the media, I should say, has been giving McCain a free pass, and that's infuriating because McCain's walking around, you know, the chip on his shoulder. He's not even flip-flopping. He's stuck permanently in the spin cycle. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, clearly he's cracked under torture, so he's certainly cracking under pressure. He'll say whatever's necessary.
And see, and I would hope that everybody, I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat, will see the hypocrisy that is John McCain.
Yeah, it's disconcerting. It's not only it's hypocrisy; he's clearly unfit.
Totally, and he better not be drinking because he's on a laundry list of meds. He's too old. He needs to just hang it up.
Yeah, yeah, I believe that he is on a laundry list of meds, and I think some of them have been suggested by his handlers. I appreciate the call, man. It's good talking to you.
Thanks a lot.
Take it easy. Dave in Los Angeles, what's happening, man?
Hey, Mark. I'm just really happy about this decision with the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
In the fact that it just takes the issue off the table. I read George Will's column this weekend with glee. And he is just whining about this decision, say it was a victory for Obama, precisely because it takes it off the table.
Yeah.
I mean, I really don't care. I'm a gun owner. I got a safe full of guns. I haven't gone shooting in probably 10 years. But, it just doesn't bother me in this whole situation. I think, you know, responsible gun ownership, whatever. I can see both sides of the fence, especially in the D.C. area. But, you know, I'm just really happy that this issue's gone. Now all we got is gods and gays left.
Yeah, well, hopefully those are, hopefully he can cross those bridges in a reasonable way. I think he's a very thoughtful guy. But let me ask you a question as a gun owner. Now, you know, you say you have several guns. It's just sort of interesting because people who generally have guns usually have more than one. Why do you collect guns?
It was just various guns for different, I shoot paper. That's all.
Yeah.
Never go hunting. I shoot paper, and when I shot, like I say, it hasn't been in 10 years. I've got a safe full of them. They're all in the safe, all locked up. And, you know, I enjoyed the different, you know, I enjoyed the rifles and I enjoyed handguns. But it was strictly shooting paper, and it was a lot of fun going out with the friends.
Right. Well, thanks for your call, man. See, I think that's the big fear, too, is that the guns will find their way into the criminal ecosystem and take on a life of their own. I think that's one of the big progressive fears and one of the big reasonable fears around gun ownership is that if you may not be home when they come to rob your house to shoot them, they will take the thing you would have shot them with. Alan in Miami, Florida, what do you got?
Never called you before. Hello there.
Nice to talk to you, Alan. How's everything down there?
Nice to talk to you. Listen, I don't think they'll come to my house, I hope, because I have alarms and, more important, to have video because I do own poisonous snakes and big cats.
Oh.
I'm calling about the gun issue.
Okay.
We are crazy in our state of Florida.
That's for sure.
We had the Castle Doctrine, which I believe in.
Okay? It's a Wild West down there.
Oh, you know about the new law?
Yeah, you could just shoot anybody and explain it later.
If you chase somebody,
yeah.
Just give them back their keys, and some old lady thinks that, I shouldn't say that, I'm 65, and some elderly person thinks you're chasing her for some other reason,
yeah.
She can blow you away.
Yeah, which would be just exciting to see an old lady with a gun anyways on some level.
Listen. It's crazy, man. I don't understand what the hell is wrong with our legislature, unless it's because they're Republicans.
So, but you're a gun owner yourself or no?
Yeah, I'm a gun owner.
Right, so you just think that you should just keep it in the house, in other words?
No, I get scared now and then because of where I go, so now and then I carry. But I'm not crazy about it, and I don't think it's going to protect me, really. But the thing that's bothering me is there's nothing wrong with self-defense, for real.
So I guess the real question is, Alan, where are you going and why are you going there?
Tom.
It's Mark.
Mark, I apologize.
Yeah.
Listen, can I leave you with this?
Okay.
You've heard it before.
This is
Miami.
Yeah.
The rules are different here.
Yeah.
They suck. Take care of yourself.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, Alan. Hey, yeah, I'm glad he left it there because I don't know where that was going, but my mother lives in the Miami region, and her man is the same way, that there's this idea that that the law does not take care of what it needs to take care of. And I'm certainly not going to, I don't have any facts on hand, but it's a real marvel that this culture holds itself together, given the possibilities for chaos and violence, that there's not more of it. And I think that is because people are decent and not because they're afraid. And I hope it stays like that. I'm going to talk about this some more. So if you want to call 866-303-2270, you can do that. And in a few minutes, we're going to talk to Emily. How do you pronounce it again?
Bazelon.
Why can't I get that in my head? Who is the senior editor and legal columnist for Slate.com about some of these decisions that the Supreme Court made. Stay with me. It's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, folks, it's about 24 past. It's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman. We're talking guns. When I was a kid, I got a gun pulled on me two or three times. There were just guns around. Yeah, it was never a robbery thing. It always seemed to be some kid showing off a gun that he probably got out of his dad's drawer. It's some guy, the first gun I saw up close, really, outside of a house or somebody showing to me in a safe way, was in an art class when I was probably a sophomore in high school. Earlier on in seventh grade, some kid pulled a gun out at a party, and I, of course, said, "What is that, fake?" And he's like, "No, it was real." Some guy pulled a gun on me and my friends when we were driving in a car to a George Thorogood concert at some point, and just started, coming up next to us like they were going to shoot us in the car. That was pretty scary. I got out of that. My buddy Dave's car got shot at by a fairly big gun, knocked a window out. Boy, when I think about it, maybe it's not the greatest thing in the world. But I'd like to, can we go down to Mike there in Kansas? Mike, what's going on? Where are you at with this?
Hey, I was just going to mention, one of the things I always hear, that well-regulated militia would never work in America, and I'm not a fan of that by any means. But if we look at what's going on in Iraq right now, you're looking at 50,000 men with rifles and homemade explosives have stopped the United States military for the last 5 years. And one of the things I look at right now in our history, if George Bush, for example, would declare himself emergency president for another 4 years, which, hope to God won't happen, but if we had a terrorist attack, I think that would push America to the point where they wouldn't be able to stand it anymore, something of that nature.
Where they wouldn't be able to what anymore?
Basically deal with having this kind of oppression for another 4 years.
Right,
I mean, I think one of the reasons Bush is walking out gracefully is because it's so close to the end.
Wow. Right. I appreciate what you're saying. It's just interesting to me that about a week and a half ago, that one of McCain's advisors basically said if we had another terrorist attack, that would really be good for the campaign. And I don't know how you look at these guys, but to me, that was a reaching out to somebody who had the willingness to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that scares me, too, because I don't think the scenario that you have put in place that we would go into some sort of martial law extended presidency would happen. But I think that there is a belief in Republican circles that if something happened, that it would be good for them. And I'm under the belief that if it wasn't looked at as a failure in security and a failure on behalf of Chertoff and a failure on behalf of this government and even suspect in the negligence of allowing it to happen, that the American people are retarded and they deserve whatever they get.
My final point, and I'll be real brief because I know you have other people. My main thing I want to point out is I always hear people say that you need to have a tank in your garage and this, and I'm not supporting that by any means, and that's not what I want. I love America very much, and I love Air America, the radio station, very much. or the network. The thing is, I've asked for the reality of American military has been stopped to a grinding halt much for the most part for the last 5 years. This country has been financially drained by 50,000 men with rifles and homemade weapons. No, you know, basically things you could buy on the internet. That's insane.
I understand that point. So you're saying that don't underestimate the power of a militia that has a purpose.
Or just people, if our government ever did become actually super tyrannical, where they were marching your house, taking all your food, and, you know, your youngest kids trying to march them off the military. Things have happened, you know, way, way back in history. I don't think it'll happen again because of communication. But, sir, I thank you for your time.
Frankie, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Well, that's interesting. I mean, the amount of organization that it would require and the amount of destability in the country that it would require for that scenario to happen, that's interesting, because what he was basically talking about is that he is a defender and a believer in what the Second Amendment was originally put in place for, and he's also frightened that it could happen again. I guess I'm an optimist. I would hope that it doesn't come to that, but maybe I'm wrong. I think that they can do it technologically now. When we come back, we're going to have Emily Bazelon to talk about the SCOTUS decision from Slate.com. Stay with me. It's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, folks, Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman. I'm sitting here sticking half-chewed pieces of Nicorette gum onto the desk here. Because that's a weird thing when you chew Nicorette, is that you just can't throw them away if you didn't finish them, because they're drugs. It's not just gum, it's drugs. And you don't want to waste drugs, from my experience. Very few people waste drugs unless they have that moment where you're like, you know what, I'm done with this. And then about an hour later, they're like, I can't believe I did that because I need it now. I'm an idiot. And then they end up at meetings. Look, well, I'm going to take more calls, 866-303-2270, in a minute. But right now I want to talk to somebody who knows what they're talking about. So here to talk to us about a few of the big rulings of the Supreme Court last week, them being terrorist suspects in Gitmo do have rights. You can't – the state can't kill people who rape kids. And it's okay to have a gun almost always. And to talk about some of those right now, senior editor and legal columnist for Slate.com, Emily Bazelon, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. So let me ask you first off, as somebody who pays attention to this stuff with some regularity and is a professional, were you surprised that the Supreme Court ruled how they did with the Gitmo terror suspects? Were you happy and surprised that there might be some hope in that court to protect the Constitution?
I wasn't that surprised about the Guantanamo case, and the reason is that it's the third ruling along these lines, and I think the court, as we move further away from the crisis of 9/11 and the Bush administration stays stuck in, you know, severely curtailing the rights of people who were picked up then, I think the court has been less and less willing to give the administration the benefit of the doubt and make the detainees bear all the brunt of their now six-year custody.
So now basically what they are able to do is challenge their detention, have legal representation, and if there is not a reason for their detention, they can seek to be released.
That's right. And, you know, it's important to emphasize here that all the court did was open the doors of the courthouse. They just said that these detainees can file the same kind of habeas corpus appeals that other criminal defendants in American history have been able to file. That's a very basic constitutional right.
And then they have to be able to afford an attorney.
Well, right. Or or in this case, there have been plenty of volunteer attorneys who have shown up and taken over that work.
Of course. I wish I had a volunteer attorney in my divorce right now. But that's another topic. And my attorney is fine. Now, in lifting the ban on handguns in D.C., what has the Supreme Court opened the door to in terms of legislating gun laws on a state-to-state level?
Well, that's just a sort of fascinating new area of law that we're going to see develop in the next few years. I mean, for court observers and lawyers, this is just like a field day. Whether or not you think it was the right outcome, it's tremendously exciting. We don't usually see this. So what's going to happen next? First of all, in the next cases, the court needs to make clear whether it will apply its ruling, which technically is just about federal law, because that's what you have in D.C., to the states. I think it will. And then the more substantive question will be what kinds of state regulation are allowed to stand in view of the fact that the court has now found that there's this constitutional individual right to bear arms.
That's interesting that there is a differentiation because it was D.C. that it is about federal law, and now that can be interpreted however a state wants to interpret it and however the state legislature wants to interpret it. So a lot of, I mean, in terms of most states in gun control, you know, what is the trend? I mean, do you see?
Well, you know, we have a range of gun control laws. There are some big cities in the country, Chicago and Philadelphia, San Francisco, that have pretty strict laws. One of the ones that's being challenged immediately is a rule in San Francisco that if you live in public housing, you're not allowed to have a gun at all. That's a little like, sort of like the D.C. law that just was struck down, which said no handguns, and if you're going to have a rifle or another kind of long gun, you have to have a trigger lock on it. And that was the kind of law that Scalia said no in his majority opinion. That goes too far. It means that this constitutional right to bear arms is an empty one. And so then the question will be about things like waiting periods and registration. Scalia gave a little list of laws that would be able to stand, like Congress will still be able to say that criminals can't have guns, the felon in possession laws, those kinds of things will all stay on the books. But then there are these other questions about laws that are more restrictive that we're going to see play out.
Now, how is this in terms of you know, constitutional scholars or people that interpret the Constitution in a specific and literal way, how does this decision how is it being criticized in terms of people who interpret the Constitution literally, interpreting the idea of the well-regulated militia? Is that just out the window now?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, basically, Scalia in his majority opinion and Stevens in his dissent had a head-to-head over this, how you have these four clauses, all these commas, questions about how you define the well-regulated militia, which Scalia called that a prefatory clause. I don't think it's out the window, but until, you know, unless there's a new composition of justices on the Supreme Court, we now have Scalia's interpretation as the one that's standing.
And what kind of clause was that? Explain that to me.
So the idea is that it's a prefatory clause, that mm-hmm. the amendment starts with this idea of a well-regulated militia. Like,
right.
That's why we would have it, but it doesn't limit the right to being in the militia.
Right. Okay, so if you are a militia of one, it's okay.
A militia of one, exactly. And you don't have to say, like, oh, I have a gun at home because I'm in the militia. You can, like, the idea is that the framers encouraged people to have guns for the militia, but also they just said you can have guns.
Okay, so he's basically saying just by logic and by mathematics is that, you know, whether it's a militia or not, basically the amendment says anyone can have a gun.
Right, although he also was careful to say that not absolutely anyone. Like I was saying before, if
right.
you're a felon, I mean, so the states can still pass some laws.
Make it illegal for killers to have guns who just kill for sports, perhaps, or
right.
psychopaths.
One would want to think that there are statutes which say that if you have a mental illness, there are restrictions on having guns. Those
yeah.
Scalia explicitly said were still okay. So we're not talking about the states and the cities not being able to regulate at all. We're talking about where is the boundary of that regulation. And one thing that was interesting about Scalia's opinion was that he declined to set a standard. You know, often with constitutional law, the court tries to give lower courts guidance by saying, well, this is the sort of test that you should impose. These are the issues you should weigh. And Scalia didn't do that. So that's left for another day.
So he's leaving it to the states to define their own broad context for what would enable a person to have a gun, what crazy is, what dangerous is, and how do you restrict that?
And he's leaving it to lower court judges to figure out how to weigh the favors against and for what the states decide to do.
Oh, my God. So there's going to be a whole new national set of legal precedents set based on events that are horrific.
Well, maybe. I mean, look, this is like, it's a very common law-ish kind of decision, which is like, instead of having this very top-down from the Supreme Court marching orders, we're going to see the case law kind of bubble up from below, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right, so the guy who comes into the courtroom with a gun and demands that he has the right to bear it in the courtroom and point it at the judge would probably be the outside example of what's not good.
Right, and then that could be the kind of, from your point of view, good facts that lead to a good law, because presumably the judge is not going to like that.
Oh, yeah, you would think.
You would think.
Depending where that is and how well he knows the guy.
Right.
So, all right, let's talk about this ruling about the death penalty in terms of being used to punish people who rape children.
Yeah.
Now, how does that argument work? I mean, in death penalty, what are the specifics about the death penalty and how it does apply?
Well, so in death penalty jurisprudence, like in all the cases, the standard the court has adopted is this idea of evolving standards of decency. And that comes out of the Eighth Amendment, which bans cruel and unusual punishment. And so the court has taken that word unusual and said, okay, like, what does it mean to be unusual? And in the last few cases, the cases where they said you can't execute mentally retarded people or people who commit crimes as juveniles, they started actually counting state statutes. And what happened in the child rape execution case was that Kennedy said, okay, we've got, you know, 50 states plus the federal government. In 45 of them, you cannot execute a child rapist. No one's put that on the books. There are only six. It's true that four of the six passed recently, but that's not enough. And so the standard has evolved away from executing child rapists.
What has been the reaction to that?
You know, I think that there's sort of a split about it. Some commentators have felt like that's a fair application of evolving standards of decency, and it's not like there's some huge number of child rapists who are, you know, waiting on death row. It's not a tool that the states have availed themselves a whole lot of. On the other hand, has been a trend toward punishing sex offenders more than we used to. All the Megan's laws, the notification rules, child porn statutes. And so the dissenters, led by Justice Alito, said, look, you know, you guys are stunting the growth of statutes that would execute child rapists, and there's no reason for us to do that.
Interesting. So now, in terms of what you experience as somebody who is whose job it is to watch this stuff, and I think probably someone who is fascinated with it, what was the biggest surprise? What was the most exciting bit of business that took place last week?
Well, I was really surprised and struck by the ruling that knocked down the big punitive damages award against Exxon. Punitive damages are this really practically only American animal. The most of the world, they don't award punitive damages. But in this country, we rely on them to do justice against these huge corporations. And the idea is that it's the only way to really punish a corporation as huge as Exxon is to take a really big chunk of money away from them. In this case, it was $5 billion.
In the context of a lawsuit?
In the context of a lawsuit.
A personal lawsuit?
Yeah, this is the Exxon Valdez
right.
oil spill, like the worst oil spill in American history.
Killed a coastline.
Yeah, drunk captain, you know, negligence, like a really bad set of facts for Exxon. And so the question was, like, could the jury not only compensate the plaintiffs for the actual harm they'd suffered, but also punish Exxon by awarding more money? And the court said they can award some punitive damages, but the punitive damages can only be as high as the compensatory damages. So in other words, if your total compensatory, all the damages for harm and suffering add up to $200 million, you can only have $200 million additional punitive damages.
So that opens the door towards corporations, if they spend more money on attorneys and tie up the court system even more, that theoretically they could continue to avoid the proper punishment.
Well, I mean, this is a huge windfall for Exxon. They
right.
saved just an enormous amount of money. And the court pulled this, like, one-to-one rule, the equation I was just talking about. They kind of pulled it out of the air, or at least they pulled it out a whole bunch of studies, as opposed to relying on any sort of findings or judgment that Congress had made. And that was really surprising to me. You know, we hear a lot of accusations of judicial activism against judges on the left. But in this case, you have Justice Stevens saying to the majority, which was the court's conservative wing,
yeah.
plus Justice Souter, saying, like, what are you guys doing? This is not judicial restraint. You're, like, making this up for Congress.
So basically, that's one of the bigger fears of people on the left and of all people who are intelligent is that the more that the Supreme Court judges in favor of corporations and protects them, the more at risk we are from criminal activity, dangerous products, and corporations cutting corners and seeing, you know, regular human beings as disposable in light of their bottom line.
And that is really an issue to watch at the Supreme Court. You know, there's been some attention this year to just a string of pro-business decisions.
Right.
The Chamber of Commerce has become a really big winner at the court. And that, those cases, you know, they're not about abortion, they're not about guns, they're harder to explain, but they can have exactly the effect that you're talking about.
It's like putting caps on lawsuits and nobody gets punished and people just become disposable. It's frightening. Thank you, Emily Bazelon, for your time. I appreciate talking to you.
Thanks very much.
You take care. That was Emily Bazelon, senior editor and legal columnist for Slate.com. I'll take more calls, 866-303-2270. It's Mark Maron. I'm in for Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, folks, Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman today and Wednesday. Tom will be back tomorrow and then gone again on Wednesday. I don't know why. I don't ask questions. I take the mic when it's offered to me most of the time. We're talking about guns. We're talking about the Supreme Court decisions. I got to be honest with you. I think that on some level, raping a kid is more heinous than murder. It's like a soul murder. It's like a murder that never stops for a lifetime. I'm against the death penalty, but I do think that some type of long-term imprisonment, I mean, raping a kid, the repercussions of that. I mean, murder, regular murder on some level is understandable and biblical in a weird way, but the other thing is heinous. And just so, obviously murder is destructive, you know, but sometimes things get out of hand, but raping a kid, anyways, I don't want to get hung up on it. John in Los Angeles, California, what's going on?
Hello, Mark.
Hi.
I just wanted to say something that I feel strongly about regarding guns. And the fact is that, like corporations and the military, guns are becoming socially obsolete. The reason why I say this is that even in the old days, as people can think of, you may be personally responsible enough to carry a gun, but even Wyatt Earp made people take off their guns when they came into town so they wouldn't be violently provoked by such a provocative item.
Tool. Yeah, a couple shots of whiskey, a little argument over a woman, who knows?
Well, you see, in the same way as wearing the wrong colors in a certain part of town,
yeah,
you can be provoked into doing something that you may otherwise not have done. And to be provoked by such a provocative thing as the gun wearing or the military stoking in society, it's become obsolete, like the trebuchet or the mace.
Right.
And all I have to say is that the world has become too small a place to use a tool such as a gun for killing food or for killing your enemy, you know, across the valley.
What if you eat your enemy? I mean,
pardon me?
What if you eat your enemy?
What if you eat your enemy?
Yeah. Threw you a curveball there, John. Thanks for your call.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. That's crazy. I think I'm not sure exactly what John was saying, but I didn't want to quite get him into explaining it. But I think what he's saying is that guns in the public sphere are unnecessary and can provoke problems. And that I would agree with. I don't think that people should be walking around with their guns in their holster. I don't agree with how Florida is handling that law and how some other states are handling the law. Apparently, some people have found loopholes in laws where they have found out that it is not illegal in any way in some states to carry a gun if you own a gun. So there's a lot of that going around, and it's posturing, it's public saber rattling, it is a false sense of an entitlement and defensiveness, and it is a statement. If you're walking around, you're not a cop, and you've got a gun on your belt, yeah, I don't care what you're saying. You're not saying, look, I'm worried about my safety. You're saying, what do you got, buddy? You looking for trouble? I got trouble. What do you got? Come on, make my day. Do it. I don't see how it could be looked at in any way. I don't know that I agree, and I would say I don't agree, actually, with the idea of people carrying arms at will. I think that having a gun in your home, specifically to protect your home, is a different thing. My father used to drive around with his gun in his glove compartment, and I think then you're putting an awful lot on your state of mind, and who the hell knows what's going to happen. Domestic, a fight, out, you know, if you're driving, road rage. Who knows? But I think that a peace of mind that can come from having a gun in the house if you don't feel efficiently protected by the police or you don't, or something has happened. I don't have a big problem with that. We will be back. We're going to talk about the human brain, about food, about me. Man, right there, what a menu, huh? How can you not stay for that? It's Marin in for Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and you lurking conservatives, it's Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom Hartman, and I feel relaxed. Maybe it's that music, because I always listen to Tom, and I'm like, wow, he's relaxed. And then I'm like, oh no, I'd better get my notebook. Tom's smart. He knows things. Sometimes when I picture Tom talking, I picture him at a blackboard. And I always learn. When you listen to me, you learn about what's wrong with my brain. I'm not going to continue the conversation about guns anymore, except I'll take one more call on guns. Cassandra in Hollywood, hello.
Hey, Mark. I think I may share some of the same brain problems that you do.
Is it a problem? I think we're enlightened. I don't see it as a problem.
Well, that's true. And the reason I don't have a gun, I have a couple reasons. One is the noble one. I'm an aspiring pacifist. Two, I've got a really bad temper, which is why I'm aspiring. And I have a perverted sense of survival, so I'm afraid I would grab the gun and temper and then turn it on myself.
Uh-huh.
And my husband, knowing that, said he's got the perfect crime. We're happily married.
Yeah.
But his perfect crime would be to leave a loaded gun and a bunch of Frontline videos on the kitchen table if he was angry with me.
Oh, he's got a plan.
He does.
Do you have a gun in the house now?
No.
Well, I appreciate that call, and I think you're right. There's different kinds of people in terms of this, because I think there are some people that, like, for instance, oh, let's take the example of, say, your wife leaving you. Not that this is not a personal thing.
Yeah.
Now, that some guys would react like, oh, my God, how am I going to go on? I'm going to kill myself. That's one kind of person. The other kind of person is like, oh, yeah, you're going to leave me? I'm going to kill you. And I think that's probably, I don't know.
Most situations, it's not good to have a gun around.
Okay, I understand your point, and it's well taken. Thanks for calling, Cassandra.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the reasons why I don't have one. I got to be honest with you. I think it's true that, I didn't really think about this before, and I will think on the fly here, that if you have a gun, you have options that you wouldn't have in both the realms that she's talking about. If you are depressed or if you are angry. If you have a gun, you can sit there and wrestle with it. You can sit there and put it on the table and go, I'm going to go out. I'm taking that guy out. That's it. And you can look at the possibility of that. And I think that would somehow change your disposition. And the same with the other thing. It's like, I don't want to live anymore. If you just have that gun sitting on the table, you're going to think differently. That's for sure. Now I'm going to change some topics here because we're going to talk about food in a little while, which I love. Love food. And we're going to talk about Well, maybe I should tell you this story because it's been sort of interesting to me. I've done some traveling lately and I don't, I like America. I like Americans. I like traveling places. But I found there was a couple of things that happened to me when I traveled that I'm not a snob. And sometimes I feel like I would like to run away to a smaller city, to a smaller town, to a place with maybe, you know, just one or two other people. Sometimes I get that thought. But I was traveling, and it's very interesting the type of fans that I have, because I had this experience. I was traveling with a couple other comics. We were in Boise, Idaho. We went to Fargo. We went to Boise. We went to Portland. Went to Newport, Kentucky. We were in St. Paul. But Boise was interesting because when you live in cities, and I've lived in Los Angeles and New York for a good chunk of my adult life, I guess you get a little spoiled. It's not that I don't appreciate the land. It's not that I don't appreciate the space. It's not that I don't appreciate the simplicity of life available in smaller cities or towns. But you do get a little spoiled when you live in cities because you're forced to sort of immerse yourself in an eclectic culture. That there's many people from different races, from different places, from different classes, from different, you know, points of view, and you're all just one big mass. I mean, LA is a little more spread out. Here in New York, you definitely feel like you're part of a larger organism, and most of the time people act in concert with that. They act responsibly. They are a little bit defensive, but it's a compassionate defensiveness. It just has to do with maintaining boundaries in a city where if you take public transportation, you're going to have a stranger 3 inches away from you at least two times a day. You're going to smell their bad hair products. You're going to see the oil on their skin. You're going to feel them brushing up against you with their sweat-soaked, humidity-drenched shirt. And you're going to have to deal with that. You're going to have to accept that as the parameters of your existence at that moment. And New Yorkers generally do, but it's a defensive respect. It's like, dude, just stay there, you know. So I go to Boise, Idaho, and there's part of me when I get there, I'm like, oh, my God, this is ridiculous. I mean, that's it. And the funny thing is about smaller towns and cities is that if you say you live in a bigger city, then they'll go, oh, you're from New York. I got to take you to this. I'll make you feel comfortable. So they take you to the one block. You know, where there's a coffee shop, a bookstore, and a guy talking to himself. And they say, huh, right? And I'm like, yeah, this is just like New York. I appreciate it. And see, that's condescending. I'm being condescending. And then what happened was even more condescending, but in a different way. That type of condescending is like, you people are rubes. And I don't feel that way. I definitely like most people, especially if they like me. And that's tenuous. But I get to Boise, and there's part of me that thinks like, oh my God, these people are stranded. I had to fight myself, you know, from going up to people going, you know, you can go. You can, there's cars, there's planes. You can take a bus if that's what you're comfortable with, but you can go. You can go to a real city where there are independently owned coffee shops and boutiques and people of different colors. But that's condescending too. And then there's part of me that thinks like, you know what? If it all hits the fan, I'm going to Boise. I'm going to go. But, you know, a guy with my disposition, if I were to show up in Boise, Idaho, you know, within a week, you know, because the town is so small, within a week, people would be talking. They'd be like, yeah, there's L.A. Mark. Yeah, I don't know. He showed up a few weeks ago. He just sits over at that table and talks to the air and writes things down on a piece of paper. I don't know. I don't know what happened, but there's a story there. So getting back to the fan thing and getting back to, I don't know what the point of it is. There's a sensitivity that some of us experience on the left. A lot of us are a little too sensitive for our own good, and some of us are bordering on some sort of mental illness. But I was at a bar. I don't drink, but I was at a bar after a show in Boise, Idaho, with a bunch of college students who had seen me work, and I was hanging out with them because I'm insecure, and it was Boise. I got nothing to do. And I go to the bathroom in the bar, and I'm walking out of the bathroom. And I guess the moral of the story is, have you had that experience where you're in a conversation with somebody and you don't realize they're crazy until you're too far into the conversation to exit with any sort of grace? So I walk out of the bathroom, and a woman goes, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my, who are you? Who are you? Who are you? And I go, I am Mark Maron. She goes, oh, I was just talking about you. I don't believe it. You saved my life. You saved my life when you were on the radio. You saved my life. And I'm like, well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's nice to meet you. And I shook her hand. I was going to walk away. She goes, wait. I need to talk to you outside now. And again, I'm in Boise. I got nothing to do. And I'm like, okay. okay, let's, okay, okay. And I always am, I'm overly available because honestly, I don't have boundaries. And when you don't have boundaries and you're talking to a crazy person, it makes you feel alive in a way. And I don't want to judge her too harshly because I do have some sympathy, but I get outside and she's like, do you know what's going on here? Do you know what's going on in Boise? Do you know about the Mormons? Do you know about what the Mormons did to me? Do you know what's going on? I'm like, I don't. And she goes, well, it's bad. And I'm like, okay, I'm sorry to hear that. She goes, do you know about the football coach and what happened with that? And I'm like, I don't. I don't. And I'm sorry. And she goes, listen, I'm buying some property up north for the people against rape. And there was a moment where I'm like, are there other kinds of people? I mean, I didn't realize that was a minority that needed territory or perhaps a fenced-in protective zone. But again, I was trying to be sympathetic. I didn't say that. I said, that's good. That's noble. That's good for you. And she goes, listen, I've got a carload of articles on the Beatles, and I've written a letter to the governor about the football coach and my case against him. And I need you to go to the governor's office with me now to deliver the letter. And it's 1 a.m. So I said nicely, I said, look, I can't. Good luck with everything. And I hate when I do that, the dismissive good luck. But, you know, I give her a hug. And I said, I hope everything works out. And she goes, wait, okay, but before I go, will you just take my business card? And I go, okay, yeah, give me your business card. She goes, oh, no, I don't have any business cards. Here's my driver's license. And I'm standing there holding a driver's license. And I'm like, wait, I can't take this. She goes, no, it's okay. It's expired and you're going to need it. And she walks away. So I'm standing there with this woman's driver's license, and she's not particularly stable, and I'm concerned, and it's not expired, and it's not from Idaho, and I don't know what to do with it. And because I'm a self-centered, narcissistic person, I get back to my hotel room, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, why do I have her driver's license? What if they find her dead somewhere, and I've got her driver's license? What am I going to say? I didn't fill in the part of the story to, you know, how the cops find me, because that wasn't necessary. I just wanted to panic because it's a hobby of mine. So I'm picturing the cop showing up after finding this woman dead and going, what are you doing with her driver's license? And me saying, no, you don't get it. No. I just met her. All right. She's got a problem with the Mormons here. And, there was an incident with a football coach. She's buying property for the people against rape. And, you know, she's got a carload of articles on the Beatles. And she had written a letter to the governor that I was going to help her deliver about the football coach. You know what? Take me in. Just cuff me. I didn't do anything wrong, but I know that there's no way I can explain this and I'm guilty of something. So please just take me in. So meanwhile, I've got to put her driver's license in the mail. So that's the Boise story. I don't know what context that has for anybody, but in a second, I want to talk about, well, I'll talk about it now for a couple minutes. Look, I have this paranoid fear that we are getting sicker, physically sicker, because of what's going on in agribusiness, what's going on in terms of how disease is evolving, creating new diseases. Like, it's very interesting. I read an article about how they're finding some colon problems, some stomach problems that may be prevalent in the culture are prevalent because antibiotics kill off parasites that would somehow manage this situation, that help our immunity, that we are really just like coral. We're just a zoo of organisms, you know, moving through the world in some sort of very delicate balance. And once that balance is thrown off, we are more susceptible to sickness. And I found this with colds, as I said earlier, because I think I remember a time where a cold lasted, say, 3 days coming, 3 days here, and 3 days going. I think I remember that time where you took some pills and you felt a little better. But now you get a cold and it's like those first 3 days, you're like, I don't know what's going to happen with this. I don't know where it's going. Like, I feel it in my head. There's a little bit in my nose. It might be going to my chest. My body's, is it a cold? Is it a flu? Is it some sort of alien, you know, amalgamation of both? You start out with a cold. You got the sniffles and all of a sudden you've got, you know, stuff coming out of you that is the wrong color and you've got aches and you're sweating and blood is coming out of your ears. Fingers are falling off and people are going, yeah, it's going around. Really? I can't use my hand. Is there something wrong? I don't know. I try to eat well, and I haven't been sick in a long time. And then you take things that people tell you to take. Let's finish this in a second, and I'll tell you what I'm taking. It's 18 Pass. I'm Mark Maron in for Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
All right, mic on. Nicotine gum out. Say your name, Mark Maron. Sorry, I don't mean to get all meta on you. Dig that. Folks, it's Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom Hartman, who was fine. He'll be back. He's traveling. He'll be back tomorrow, and then I'll be back Wednesday. And I have this fantasy that I'm going to be more prepared somehow. Because I don't do this every day, sometimes I get into this tunnel of like, oh, my God, I have to fill my head with things and then go on there and spit them out in a different version. I got to fill my head with things and then turn them around in my head and spit them out. I didn't get to that thing about the brain. I'm going to have to do that on Wednesday. That's okay. We're talking about sickness. People like to talk about sickness. As I said, I'm just getting over something. As of yesterday, I didn't know if I was going to have the voice to do this. That would have been bad. One gig I get to fill in. I can't talk. But I'm okay. You know why I'm okay? Because I take oregano pills. That's right. I'm not selling anything, but that was what I was told. And I was told it by a credible source. A guy at a fish store who handles fish every day. So he's rugged. He's doing something. He's not on the boat, but he's talking to the guy on the boat who brings him the fish and they put him out on the ice. Whatever. It's that world. It's a world connected somehow to fishermen who are out there doing the thing way out there in the ocean, need to be healthy. But then there's a sort of a gap in the story because the guy at the fish store told me that the guy who owns the guitar store across the street told him about it. So I don't know. Musicians is not as necessarily as noble as a fisherman. Is noble the right word? As rugged. Or as consistent, really, on a security level. But, you know, fishermen, you know what? I'm getting off the point. I was told that oregano oil helps you. And it did. It would help me. And I would go out and I would buy high-octane oregano oil. I would go to Erewhon in Los Angeles, and they had this stuff there that was like not just – it wasn't oreganol. It wasn't from a company that makes oregano pills. It was some sort of homespun operation that came in little vials. And it was like, you know, like, this is dangerous. It could burn. And anything that says that when it's supposed to be good for you, you're like, oh, yeah, I need the stuff that hurts. Because that'll make me feel better. Give me the stuff that hurts. It's like Listerine. Why do I gargle with that stuff? Why do I keep it in my mouth for 30 seconds? Because it hurts. I'm like, it's doing something. It's killing things. No, it's not. It's just burning your face. I know, but that's good. It's good to burn the face. It makes you better. So anyways, Andre in Washington, what's going on with this?
Hey, buddy. You know, I know exactly what you're talking about when you in travel and you feel like a strange line. I live in Washington, D.C., and I went to Nashville, Tennessee a couple of months ago, and oh, my God, I felt like I was in a Chevy pickup commercial.
Yeah.
It was crazy down there, especially when they gave me the Lynchburg lemonade to drink.
Oh, no.
But, hey, you know, that's what they're doing. You know, when in Rome, you know, do like the Romans. But, yeah, I believe everything you said about us getting sicker. I think we're – yeah, you remember the movie War of the Worlds? We're kind of making aliens out of ourselves to the point where, you know, the things that we as humans earn the right to have here and to be free of in terms of illnesses, we're kind of doing away with that. I mean, you know, I have a little son, and every time I turn around, my wife is trying to pump him up with antibiotics to make him feel good. I'm like, you know, babe, I mean, after a while, this guy's immune system is going to go to the toilet because he can't fight anything off.
That's right. And there's also antibiotics in some of the foods we have. And I'm going to have a guest on. Thanks for your call, Andre. I'm going to have a guest on in a minute. This could get frightening because my original intention was, you know, to talk about how the immunity system, how the immune system gets broken down because of antibiotic use and just because of the resilience of certain strands of virus and bacteria at this point in time. But this guy's going to talk primarily about genetically altered foods. Because we don't know what a lot of those are and what the repercussions of eating and consuming that are. Because I don't even know what most of them are. You know, I was vigilant about it initially, but now it's just commonplace. And who the hell knows? So get ready for a big buzzkill of entertainment. Why is your food killing you? Coming up next, Mark Maron in for Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Wow, that's some dramatic music. I don't know if I can follow that with anything important sounding. Tom has got some earnest music going on this machine, man. Wow. Okay, so now I feel like next up, a very dire situation. Look, folks, I remember years ago I cut out an article about a genetically altered pig. Okay, and the reason I cut that article out, it was right when they okayed patents for genetically altered animals. And I thought that was a sign of the end of the world. I just did. Because the pig in question had been spliced with some human genetic material to make it leaner. So in my head, I'm like, okay, does that mean that somehow or another we're cannibalizing? Isn't that cannibalism if we're eating a pig that's part human? And you know, I know some human pigs for a couple of different reasons, and that's not a fat comment. But I mean, but the idea that real genetic material from human beings are being incorporated in other things, that just creeped me out. And we don't realize just how much genetically altered food we're ingesting and what that could do. So I figured, why not scare the hell out of you and have a guest to speak directly to that? So our guest right now, Executive Director of the Institute for Responsible Technology, is the author of Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Food, Jeffrey M. Smith. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Now, Jeffrey, this is going to get nasty, isn't it?
Well, if you wanted to, we have plenty of ammunition to scare the hell out of people if people want to do that.
Well, now, my specific questions are, first off, in coming off of the pig story I just told, how much genetically altered food is genetically altered with human genes?
Well, none of our food has human genes in it.
Oh,
there was a rice that was growing with human genes in it for pharmaceutical crop in Kansas, which was harvested. But most of the GM crops in the market, and there's four principal ones, soy, corn, cotton, and canola, have genes from viruses or bacteria.
Okay, now what are the primary, in your mind, because we don't have that long, what are the primary repercussions, the most damaging and most frightening in terms of this, and why?
Well, we've identified thousands of sick, sterile, and dead livestock, thousands of toxic and allergic reactions in humans, and damage to virtually every organ and every system studied in the lab. So some of the most viscerally uncomfortable ones is that we know that genes can transfer from genetically modified foods into the DNA of our gut bacteria and continue to function, continuing to produce these foreign proteins inside of our gut long after we stop eating genetically
altered. All right, so you're saying that the renegade strand of genetically altered DNA or RNA can function as a virus again and infect the bacteria in our stomachs?
Well, it actually operates as a kind of a bacterial gene that jumps into other bacterial DNA and can continue to function. And that was discovered in the only human feeding study ever conducted.
So that's actually more advanced than a virus.
Well, yeah, it is possible that the viral genes that they put into things like zucchini and crookneck squash and Hawaiian papaya can also transfer into viruses or bacteria inside of our gut. So that's also a possibility.
But so, because my understanding about viral replication is that, as opposed to being a double strand of DNA, they are a single strand of DNA that are seeking a body. But you're saying that these are bacterial agents that infect other bacterial agents that are probably good for us.
Exactly. So you transfer, let's say, we know that the gene that's inserted into soybeans transfers. Now, imagine if the gene that creates its own pesticide in corn were to transfer from a genetically modified corn chip into our gut bacteria. It might turn it into living pesticide factories producing pesticides inside of our intestines for the long term. So that's a theoretical possibility that's never been studied, and yet these foods are already on the market.
That's frightening, and I'm uncomfortable to know that right now I could be just a poison factory.
In addition, the soy itself, when it was fed to mice and rats, they showed changes in their young sperm cells, changes in the DNA of the embryos, and in one case, more than half of the offspring died when their mothers were within 3 weeks when their mothers were fed GM soy, compared to only 1 out of 10 when the mothers were fed non-GM soy.
Now, that's frightening as well. Now, do you have any solid research around how this is directly affecting our immune system, or whether or not there is a resilience growing among fairly common bacterial and viral agents like colds and flus?
Well, we have almost no research on humans, only one feeding study, no human clinical trials, no post-marketing surveillance. We do know that soon after GM soy was introduced to the UK, soy allergies skyrocketed by 50%. We know that in one small study that one individual showed a skin prick reaction to the GM soy but not to the non-GM soy. We also know that GM soy has as much as 7 times the level of a known allergen and a completely new allergenic protein that was not intended or tested. So there's a lot of reasons why genetically modified soy and corn might be contributing to the increase in allergies, but we can't say for sure that it is, because there's been a kind of a hijacking at the FDA when it was originally introduced, and the person in charge of policy was Monsanto's former attorney, later Monsanto's vice president, who said no safety testing is necessary, going against the general recommendation of the scientists at the FDA.
And this is one of those situations that you see so often in American business and its relationship with the government, is that they're willing to take this risk to sort of increase their bottom line or protect their bottom line or to make it cheaper for them. And then they'll just put it into their bottom line that, let's say, 20, 30 years from now, we've got these, out of control viral agents or bacterial agents, or we have these allergic reactions or possible deaths that they do eventually investigate and conclude that it was the reason was this lack of oversight. And then they just pay everybody out. It's like cigarettes. It's like anything else.
Well, actually, it's a step more dangerous for two reasons. First of all, the changes to the entire food supply. Virtually everyone eats genetically engineered foods in every meal because nearly all processed foods have soy, corn, cotton, or canola in them. Yeah. Secondly, once you put the genetically modified organism out into the environment, the self-propagating genetic pollution could theoretically outlast the effects of global warming and nuclear waste. So it's got widespread and long-term consequences.
So you're saying that all of that will be left after everything ends is these genetically altered bodies, bacteria, or viruses that we created, and they will replace us?
Well, not necessarily replace us, but just as long as corn is on the planet and the soy, etc., we've altered their gene pool by creating artificial changes and artificial swaps of genes that had never naturally occurred in those organisms. And we can't recall it. It would be like trying to recall genetically modified salmon from the ocean or mosquitoes from the environment.
I see what you're saying. So once the it enters the ecosystem and starts replicating itself, it will probably overtake any sort of organically based corn, soy, or fish.
Not necessarily overtake, but just coexist and spread. And so you'd end up with, you'll have a genetically engineered ecosystem whether you like it or not.
So it's Pandora's box.
Yes.
Wow. Well, this is uplifting. Now, so what needs to be done and what are you doing?
Well, at our Institute for Responsible Technology, at responsibletechnology.org, we have a campaign for healthier eating in America, which we're about to launch big time, involving the disbursement of tens of millions of non-GMO shopping guides and also information about the health dangers of genetically engineered foods presented en masse to the population, because we believe we can achieve the tipping point of consumer rejection of GMOs as early as next year. We already saw that with bovine growth hormone, the genetically engineered drug from Monsanto, when a significant percentage of health-conscious shoppers decided not to use it. It's now been kicked out by Walmart, Starbucks, Kroger's, and 40 of the top 100 dairies within the last 2 years.
Well, thank God there's some hope. I appreciate you spending a little time with us, Jeffrey M. Smith, and people will go to that website. What is it again, sir?
It's responsibletechnology.org.
Appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
Take care. See, that is it. This stuff creeps me out more than anything else, is these ridiculous alliances within the government with big business. Big business in the way that it hurts us, and it almost always does. It was like that discussion we had about the Supreme Court ruling in favor of big business, in favor of caps on malpractice suits, in favor of limiting punitive damages to corporations that destroy the planet or destroy a large number of people or destroy ecosystems. And this is all because any administration or any politician or group of politicians that is aligned and made promises to corporate entities to protect them or do their bidding, if they help them get into office, this is what you get. You get a stacked administration. You get an FDA that doesn't do what the FDA is supposed to do. There's no oversight on anything. There's nothing efficient in testing or anything else. And they are willing to let people die and just accommodate that when and if they have to, if they can even trace it back to that. That, to me, is horrifying. And that is just the fact that It's my nightmare vision in that, being that we don't manufacture much here anymore, but appetite and need, we are just the world's mouth and everyone's just a consumer and that's what they do to do their part in the great global economy is eat and buy. And if, once they run out of the ability to do that, that they're just off the grid. Let them die. That's why there's no nationalized health care, because the way the government is set up now in its alliance with corporate America and corporate entities around the world is that they need the turnover. They're not looking to protect you. If you can't play the game, sorry, nothing we could do for you. Adapt or die. That's uplifting. I actually do have some uplifting things. I'm going to tell you some healthy foods to eat and perhaps maybe a little entertaining story about the upside of the economic downturn in terms of America's diet. So stay with me. It's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, my God. Coming in for landing here, it's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman. Holy mackerel. Sardines, actually, are better for you. Mackerel, if I'm reading this correctly. Man, I don't know what the hell to do sometimes. It's hard to be entertaining when you're talking about things that are true. And that's all people want, is to be entertained. Please enforce our denial. Please. Could you please? This is the great age of avoidance. That's what it'll be called in the history books. The age of avoidance before the last depression. It's interesting what entertains progressives. Could you make it really bleak, please? Could you bring us down to the lowest possible level in terms of, you know, trying to figure out how to find hope? Could you do that? Well, here's a little hope on the food tip. I just got a little list of 11 foods that it says the 11 best foods you aren't eating, but I'm happy to say I eat a lot of them. These are all good things that you should be eating, and I just share it with you. Beets are good, very good. Cabbage, excellent. It's interesting that the Eastern European diet has some good things to it. I ate at Veselka last night. I had beets last night. Swiss chard, cinnamon, pomegranate juice, dried plums, prunes, pumpkin seeds, sardines, turmeric, and frozen blueberries. That sounds like a hell of a pie. That's something someone would cook up, you know, one of your vegan friends. Try this. It's interesting. I invented it. Always, the reaction to that's always going to be like, oh, yeah, that is interesting. What is that weird taste I can't decide on? That's turmeric. It adds something, though, because, you know, not everybody makes a cabbage and blueberry pie. Except for the type of things that vegans have to come up with. Not that I'm judging. Huh? Virginia, Seattle, Washington. What do you have to tell us? Make it bleak.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted to mention also our medical quality is going down. We get all these pills that just barely keep us alive long enough for us to take another dose, but in the long run, they'll kill us. We're being murdered. Our air quality is down. I was born in 1933, and there's less oxygen in the air now than there was when I was born. We're being murdered. That's the bottom line.
Well, thank you very much. That was exactly what I was looking for.
Okay, thank you.
I appreciate it. Well, I got something that's fun. This is interesting. That here's a little silver lining in the economy going down the toilet. Apparently, because of fuel prices and what that's doing for transit costs and manufacturing costs, food manufacturers. Faced with the choice between raising prices or just putting less in the package, are going with putting less in the package. Look, there's a solution to the obesity problem, and it is a failing economy. You can still get the same size box, and you might never notice that there's an ounce or two less of your favorite sugary cereal. Yeah. Apparently, Kellogg's started shipping Apple Jacks, Cocoa Krispies, Corn Pops, Fruit Loops, and Honey Smacks, containing an average of 2.4 fewer ounces. So if you've got one of them obese kids, don't tell them. And don't put the, but now you have to be proportionate in your rationing. that you have to, you know, not eat the whole bowl. Apparently, there are similar reactions going. Tropicana orange juice containers are shrinking from 96 ounces to 89. Wrigley's is, man, this is going to be controversial. Wrigley's is dropping its 17-stick plenty pack in favor of a 15-stick swim pack. I'm furious! How can they do it? I've got my gum paste exactly right. Now I have to buy it at different times, and I have to... Oh, my God, I'm overwhelmed. Dial soap now weighs half an ounce less, so you're going to have to be a little less cleaner. But that's good. You shouldn't take so many showers. What else? Count containers of Country Crock spread, Hellman's mayonnaise, and Breyer's ice cream have all swim down to take some out. So there you go. This is very interesting. We can't charge them more. Just keep it in the same size box and put less in it. It's kind of lying, but, you know, in a way it's healthy. So if you don't know why all these foods are good for you, I try to take care of myself. And certainly this is an issue that I always have. What is it about? Isn't there something to be said about having a disposition that things are going to be okay, that if I eat the best I can and I behave as properly as I can in my life, that it's going to help? Sometimes I think that, you know, when I do these shows or when I talk to other progressives, if they get a little dour, that there's some sort of thrill in it, that there's some sort of consistency to bleakness. But I always think there is hope for some reason. Maybe I'm crazy, but I always do. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, what's on your mind?
Hi, Mark.
Hi.
When I heard you say the things you were saying at the beginning of the show, I was hooked. And you're giving us reality is hope. We need to know this stuff. And I wrote down this Institute for Responsible Technology. But what I was thinking of when you were talking about that, because I had some kind of virus for weeks. I have never been this sick. I'm not a meat eater. But I was thinking about something in the air, open-air biological testing, because I don't trust this administration.
That's right. Yeah, it's got to be something.
And there's an old book called Clouds of Secrecy, and it talks about, you know, governments doing this, experimenting on us. And of all the people that not to be trusted, it's these folks.
That's absolutely right, Cynthia, and I appreciate your call.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You know, I don't even think they're – I think it's probably more along the line of just, you know, not – engaging in any sort of testing and doing whatever necessary to make money or protect the bottom line. I don't believe that they're necessarily just, there's some sort of weird kind of dispenser of badness. You know, in the Pentagon, there's some guy going, should we turn it on now just to see what happens? Let's just see what happens. But they are doing that with genetically altering foods, with, you know, additives to water, additives to foods, preservatives, medicines, you know, like Vioxx and things that things aren't properly tested. I think that the earlier caller who said that we're all being murdered is right to a degree in the fact that medications are meant and designed to keep people buying medications, not necessarily to cure or heal, but to placate or make money. I think that if we lived in a fair world that really cared about the people in it, that they would make all these things affordable and safe. But that's just not the priority. And then you get into that discussion of how do you make it the priority? Without talking about socialism or justice or real democracy or getting rid of business interests in Washington or perhaps, you know, living on a farm. That's possible. We could all go upstate, start growing stuff. Yeah, I'll do that. That's what I'm going to do. I'll go up there with Cedar. I'm going to go up north. Maybe I'll move in with him. I'll just farm. I'm going to be a gentleman farmer. Well, folks, I've had a good time. I hope it didn't get too bleak at the end there. There is hope. There is truth out there. I'm certainly trying to find it, but apparently because of my brain, it's not always easy to figure out what that is. And we all have that, and I'll talk about that on Wednesday. How's that for an over-a-day tease? Tom will be back tomorrow. Have a good day. It's going to be okay, or not. I don't know. Just eat something nice. I'm Mark Maron, been in for Hartman. Take care.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.